Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 152, Kitchen Questions, February 2020. Hey everybody, thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I'm Roger, your host, and this is the podcast that's all about home cooking, getting in the kitchen, having fun, learning new things, becoming part of a great home cook community. That's what we're here for today. And today I'm rounding up some cooking questions that I've been sitting on that have been in my queue that I need to address on the show. So I'm going to dedicate today's episode to tackling a few of those. I'm still working on wrapping up my pasta and my wine episodes, but for now I thought maybe I'll get this one out in the meantime so I'm not leaving everybody hanging, waiting for some new episodes from the kitchen counter. So we'll do that today. We'll do the some kitchen questions. Of course, before we do that, I want to remind everybody that the show notes for this particular episode will be at kitchencounterpodcast.com/152. That will get you to the show notes. And for episodes like this, where I'm just answering some questions and there's not one common theme, I don't get too in-depth on the show notes. I don't list out all the questions and all the answers, but I will definitely put in a summary of the questions and the topics and then any links to content that I might mention during the course of the show. So if I mention a recipe or a technique or a YouTube video or something, I will definitely put those in the show notes over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/152. So you can find them over there. If you'd like to send me an email, you can do so at feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. That's where several of the questions today came to me from. You can also get me on the Facebook Messenger service, or if you'd like to become a little more involved in the community that we've got going on, you can join our Facebook group over at the, actually the easiest way to get to it is just to go to kitchencounterpodcast.com/group. That will forward you to the private Facebook group. You can ask to be let in, and we've got a small but mighty group of home cooks over there that love to share pictures and questions and triumphs and failures and all sorts of fun stuff over there. So definitely check that out if you're a Facebook person and you're interested in the community. All right, then, without further ado, let's jump right into this episode and tackle some kitchen questions. All right, so these are in no particular order. I just kind of grabbed them from email or Facebook or wherever and dumped them into my Evernote. So I had them in a list here. So I'm just going to tackle these as I put them in. You know, as always, when I'm doing questions like this too, in some cases, I might not have all the answers. But if you have a particular answer for one of the folks that are asking questions, or if you have more detail that you'd like to share, definitely let me know. Either by posting it in the Facebook group or sending me an email, again, over to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. And I'm happy to forward that on to whoever originally asked the question. This first question being a case in point, I don't necessarily know I have the answer to this, but maybe somebody listening does. This is from Joan in Alberta, Canada. Joan's been listening to the podcast for about a year. And she has a very specific question here, and I'm just going to jump right into the middle of her email here to get this. Joan says, I'm searching for an old recipe my granny used to make. You spoke of your heritage in your January show, German-Russian, which she was as well. She made something we call cheesecakes. They were not anything to do with the cream cheese cheesecake desserts of today. These were deep-fried turnovers of sorts with a filling of dry cottage cheese, raisins, cinnamon, and maybe a small amount of sugar. The dough was a yeast dough, I believe. She rolled out circles of dough, put a spoonful of filling in the middle, pinched the edges shut, and they were ready to fry. These were a family favorite, and when Granny made these for everyone, it was truly an occasion. Not to be forgotten, the memory lives on. Try as I might, I haven't been able to locate a recipe, though I have scoured the internet. Are you familiar with anything of the sort? Do you have anything like this in your recipes? Thanks for looking, Joan, Alberta, Canada. So Joan, I think I sent you an email before and I wasn't immediately familiar with what you're talking about because I don't remember anything like this that like my mom made in the past. The raisins kind of threw me off. But that being said, I do have a book here that I picked up a couple of years ago. I went to a Germans from Russia convention, Heritage Society convention in Pierre, South Dakota. I think I might have mentioned it on the show. Anyway, while I was there, I picked up a cookbook called Food and Customs, Recipes of the Black Sea Germans. So I was thumbing through this, thinking of your question, and I did find something that might be on the right track. And I'll actually, you know, this is one of those spiral-bound, typewritten sort of cookbooks. I don't know how widely available it is. I'm looking at it right now. But what I will do is I will put a link to the place you can buy it from, the Germans from Russia Heritage Society. But I'll also share the particular recipe in here that I think might get you on the right track. This is for something called Placinda. That's Placinda. I know that it's spelled and pronounced different ways. Sometimes it's Placinda with a B. Sometimes it's Placinda with a G. But these are basically turnovers. They call for them being baked, but it's very similar to the type of dish I think you describe. There's a couple differences. This does not look like a yeast dough, and these are baked instead of fried. But there is one filling option with pumpkin, cinnamon, and raisins. It seems to me it'd be very easy to substitute cottage cheese in for pumpkin, and you've pretty much got the same thing. So maybe this will get you on the right track. Placinda, traditionally pumpkin turnovers from the sort of the German-Russian food ways. But if anybody listening, because I know a few of you have written me telling me that we have a similar ancestry, if any of you know what Joan might be looking for, I would be grateful, and she would too, if you'd send me an email and let me know what you know. But yeah, Placinda, Joan, if you haven't run across that yet, you may have. I'll send you the page and post the page at the show notes for this particular recipe. And, you know, maybe that'll get you a step closer to finding Granny's turnovers. Everybody, I think, who comes from a family that cooks has those recipes, right, that you wish you knew how to make, or you wish you would have written down, or you wish you would have learned from mom or grandma or grandpa or whoever. But you didn't, and now you just agonize over it because you can't quite replicate it. And even if you can kind of replicate it, it still doesn't taste quite the same, you know, as grandma used to make. I think I've mentioned before, for us, it's cream noodles, which are sort of a ravioli style of a noodle with heavy cream inside, and then sort of pan-fried and poached is the best way to describe it. Very rich. And really a treat for the family, but none of us are really good at making them. And, you know, we all wish we would have spent more time learning from mom when we could. But, you know, someday one of us will master it, I'm sure. All right, Joan, good luck in your search. All right, the next one comes from Lisa from Grayson, Georgia. And this is short and sweet. Lisa asks, when would I use cornstarch instead of flour for thickening sauces? This is a very good question. And one I'm not sure I've talked about a whole lot, but it's a very common occurrence when you might want to thicken a sauce and you need to decide whether you want to do that with flour or cornstarch or even a handful of other thickening agents like perhaps arrowroot, for example. But there's a couple of parts to this answer, Lisa. And one part I would say it might be a little bit personal preference, but I'll give you some ideas of how they differ and how they're similar, and then maybe that will help you be able to decide on the fly when you want to use cornstarch or when you want to use flour. So first of all, both contain starch, of course, and that's why they're a great thickening agent. Cornstarch is actually essentially pure starch, where flour isn't. So cornstarch is actually a more powerful thickener or a more concentrated thickener. What I mean to say is you don't need as much cornstarch as you do flour for the same amount of thickening. So that's one thing to keep in mind. But I think in my mind, the biggest difference between the two is cornstarch is a great, very quick thickener. So if you just want thickening without a lot of cooking involved, cornstarch is a great way to go. Cornstarch is a much more neutral flavor than flour. If you just taste a little bit of both sometime, put a little bit on your tongue, you'll notice flour has, well, a floury taste to it. And cornstarch, though it's kind of dry and powdery, doesn't have much of a flavor to it. So when you're thickening with cornstarch, it's a lot less likely that you're going to impart any sort of a flavor to your dish. It's much more neutral. Now, flour even though it does have a flavor, it doesn't necessarily mean whatever you add it to thicken is going to taste floury. It just means you have to cook it a little bit more to sort of cook that raw flour taste out of it. Even though cornstarch is a better quick thickener, and, you know, because it's pure starch, essentially, it's much more powerful at thickening, it does have the peculiar property that if you cook it for a long time, it will tend to lose its thickening and it will thin out. And sometimes your sauces won't necessarily break, but they just won't have the same thickness as when you first put the cornstarch into them. So if you're going to thicken with cornstarch, don't plan on doing a lot of cooking after the fact. It's really great, for example, in Asian cuisine when you're just looking to thicken a sauce right at the end. Flour, on the other hand, takes a heck of a lot longer to cook out its thickening power. That's why you can use flour to make a roux, perhaps, where you're cooking it with a butter or oil over a long period of time to darken it. Its thickening power does weaken as it darkens, but it still does have thickening power. That's not really something you can do effectively with cornstarch. So if you're planning on cooking for a long time after the thickening, again, in the case of a roux, flour is your go-to starch. One more thing I would say about both of them is appearance. So interestingly, cornstarch typically gives you a very glassy or a very shiny, silky sauce. Again, think sort of Asian sauces that will give you a much glossier finish, as opposed to a flour where you're perhaps making it with gravy. Flour tends to dull and mute the colors and the shine of a sauce. So you tend to have a much more matte, much more flat looking sauce when you use flour. So those are some of the differences between cornstarch and flour. As I said at the beginning, there's not a definite do use that one, don't use this one sort of an approach. It does come down to personal preference. Just keep these differences in mind when you're deciding which one you want to use. Personally, for most of the cooking I do, you know, I'm probably an 80% flour, 20% cornstarch thickening type of a person. And I think that just comes down to the types of sauces that I'm trying to thicken, or if I'm making gravies or things like that. With the exception being Asian cooking, I rarely, or pretty much never, use flour when I'm thickening an Asian sauce. I generally go with the cornstarch there. So just to summarize, cornstarch is neutral flavored. You need to use less of it for the same thickening power as flour. It results in a glossier, shinier sauce, but it doesn't hold up to prolonged cooking. It will thin out, as opposed to flour, which is not neutral flavored. It does have a floury taste, so it requires some cooking out. It results in a more dull colored sauce, and it can hold up to prolonged cooking a little bit better and still maintain its thickening power better than cornstarch. So keep that in mind, and hopefully that helps you decide next time you need to thicken a sauce whether you want to use cornstarch or flour. All right, Lisa, thanks for the question. It's an excellent question. All right, Cliff from Monroe, Michigan. Cliff, who's been a member of the Facebook group, he posts several times in there. He's always making something delicious and posting it in there. He wrote, loved your last episode. I would love what you suggested on the Facebook group that you sampled some of the quote-unquote store-bought products, such as harissa, chimichurri, roux, etc. But keep this in mind, this is a suggestion from a person who had never done a podcast and has no idea what keeps people's interest. That's okay, Cliff. I still am not sure of that myself. That's why I'm always doing different things. Oh, he says, also for the record, I love saffron and have probably the most recipes on their app, over 200. He's not talking about the saffron spice. He's talking about the cookbook or the recipe management app that I talked about a couple episodes ago. And I actually did a whole dedicated episode when I talked to the founder, Julia Awad. So I will find the link to that and put it in the show notes. But yeah, Cliff, I do plan on doing some product reviews in the near future. I know it's not realistic that all of us home cooks make everything we do from scratch, especially if you have a family and a busy life. That's usually just not feasible, right? I do it too. I buy store-bought things for shortcuts all the time. And I think I will try to figure out a way. In fact, I have a couple of products already in my pantry that I might start with. I'm going to keep it a secret for now because I'm not totally sure how I'm going to start or how I'm going to do it. But in the next few episodes, definitely look for some sort of new product review, taste testing, sampling, cooking trial something like that when it comes to store-bought products to help us shortcut our cooking. So Cliff, thank you for that feedback. That's great. Okay, let's see. Terry from Redding, California. This is another short but sweet one, and this is something I've talked about recently. Terry asks, when are you going to review a meal kit delivery service? Terry, I'm going to review a meal kit delivery service as soon as I get off my lazy chair and start a trial with one of them. Every time I go to start one, I'm always thinking I don't want to sign up for some long-term commitment. And I know there's ways you can do like a three-meal trial and things like that. I just really need to sit down and do it. If any of you have any quick links or tips on where to go for one of these meal kit delivery services, like HelloFresh, for example, would probably be one that I would look at doing. If you have any links on, you know, trial signups or anything like that, send them my way. Email them to me. That would be helpful to me, and that would get me on the fast track to actually doing a review of these things, which I really do want to do. So yeah, Terry, that's kind of where I'm at with that. So I appreciate the email poking me to continue on with that. I will try to make a commitment here that by the time spring officially rolls around, I will have done a meal kit delivery service review. Okay, let's see. Next one comes from Carmen in St. Cloud, Florida. That sounds like a cool place. I've never been. I've been to Florida. I've just not been to St. Cloud. That's a cool name. All right, Carmen, here's her question, or his question. Many recipes I read call for sauteing aromatics like onion or garlic or even a mirepoix. And remember, a mirepoix is a combination of carrot, onion, and celery, right? Many recipes I read call for sauteing aromatics before adding other ingredients in dishes where there is prolonged cooking. Is this technically correct? I thought sauteing was the act of cooking something very quickly over high heat to maintain its texture. Don't you want to do the opposite with aromatics in most recipes? This is an interesting question, Carmen. And yeah, technically, I think you're correct. And I know the term sauteing is used broadly in most recipes on blogs, things like that. However, from a strictly technical sense, you're right. Sauteing is cooking over high heat with a little bit of oil or fat in a quick fashion, right? So if you're sauteing some vegetables, for example, typically the goal of that is to cook them quickly with a little bit of oil over high heat so they cook, but they don't soften up or get soggy. Because usually sauteing is an end in and of itself, right? So when you saute vegetables, you're going to serve them as soon as you've sauteed them. The other method, which is what you're alluding to here, is called sweating, or at least that's what I call it, and I think that's the generally accepted term. And that's the act of cooking things like aromatics over a lower temperature, over a longer period of time, in order to extract flavor and moisture to soften those aromatics up, because you're typically going to use them in a dish that's going to be cooking for a while, for example. So they are not necessarily an end to themselves when you sweat vegetables. You're putting them in, or you're going to add ingredients to those, but you've kind of cooked them down, drawn out some flavor, softened them up. And that's a lot of times when a recipe calls for quote-unquote sauteing vegetables, where you may end up just adding more ingredients to the pan because you're going to, I don't know, you're making soup or something, for example. Sauteing in that sense is usually the wrong term. But I mean, we can generally interpret and work around that. So just because a recipe says saute this and then add some chicken stock and then cream and simmer on low for an hour, I think sometimes as home cooks, our minds can just make the logical leap, right? That really what you're doing is not sauteing. You're sweating those vegetables. You're breaking them down a little bit before they go into the dish. I know myself, I'm guilty of incorrectly using the term saute. I try to be aware of the fact that usually what I ask for in a lot of recipes is sweating and more slowly cooking the aromatics and vegetables and things like that. So it's a good catch. And something you should certainly be aware of. But the short answer, I think, and the thing to keep in mind is if whatever calls for sauteing is sort of going to be served that way, it's sort of the final dish, then yeah, it probably really is a saute. If it's telling you to saute it, but then those ingredients are going to be used as part of a longer cooking dish. Probably not sauteing. It's probably more like sweating is what you need to do. A long time ago in an episode, I remember talking about making a soup recipe, and I want to say it was from like a Rachel Ray cookbook, if I'm not remembering incorrectly. And it was weird because the recipe didn't ask for the aromatics to be sweated first or cooked first. It was like cook the soup, and then near the end, you put in the onions and things like that, which I did against my better judgment. And it ended up with a soup that had very crunchy vegetables in it. It was not very appealing. So just think to yourself when you're reading your recipes, do I want the recipe, the vegetables, for example, to be crunchy and full of texture and bite? Or is that not the goal of the cooking method? Okay. Carmen, I went way on and on about your question, but hopefully that helped clarify us, I think, what you're asking and the difference between sauteing and sweating vegetables. Okay. Here's a couple more questions for today. This is from Robert in Columbus, Ohio. Robert says, I'm planning a visit to Oregon this summer. Oh, very cool, Robert. If you've never been, you're in for a treat. I'm planning a visit to Oregon this summer. Are there any culinary adventures or restaurants I shouldn't miss while I'm there? When I travel, I like to eat. When I travel, I like to eat like the locals to really get a feel for the place I visit. Well, that's a great question. You know, Oregon's a big state, and we have a lot of different regions and a lot of different cuisines and specialties and things like that. So without knowing exactly where in Oregon you're going to visit, it's a little tricky to answer, but I will make an assumption that Portland will probably be on your itinerary, especially if you're flying. So it goes without saying that Portland, Oregon, it's really taken its place among the great cities, culinary cities in the United States. So do a little research on Yelp and the internet. I don't really have any restaurants off the top of my head in Portland you should visit. I mean, there's so many great ones. Find what you like to eat, do some research, and take a look. Now, that being said, as far as quintessential Oregon things I think you should do while you're here, again, not knowing how long you'll be here or where you're going, but two things jump immediately to mind. One is you should certainly go to the coast if you can. Newport is a really, really great town on the central Oregon coast. It's got a great historic working bayfront. You can get lots of fresh seafood there. There's lots of interesting art galleries and whatnot if that's sort of your thing. It's got the Oregon Coast Aquarium, the Hatfield Marine Science Center. So if you have kids and they're looking for some interesting things, those are great places to visit. And you can get yourself some Dungeness crab if you're not coming in too late of summer. So, you know, August is typically, I think, when the season for that, depending on availability anyway, right? It's been kind of a weird fishery lately with the climate change and all that stuff. But if you can get a hold of some Dungeness crab, you should definitely try that. That's probably Oregon's most famous seafood product. And every inch of beach in Oregon is public. There are no private beaches in Oregon. So anywhere you go, if you can get to the beach, you can go on the beach and enjoy it. So definitely do that. The other thing about Oregon, I would say, would be to definitely take advantage of the fact that we are a world-class wine-producing region. Particularly the Willamette Valley is a magnificent place to try Pinot Noir wine and other varietals as well, but there are tons and tons of great wineries and vineyards you could visit to do tastings and all sorts of fun stuff, and most of them serve really, really great food. I mean, of course, around Salem, near where I am, there's the old standby Willamette Valley Vineyards, which is, you can't go wrong if you could only go to one place. That would certainly be a great option to stop. But there's so many others, from the well-known to the literal mom-and-pop vineyards and wineries, and all of them are typically open on the weekends, certainly through the summertime, for drop-in tastings and things like that. So you should certainly do that. But not to shortchange Oregon's beer industry either. We do have some pretty amazing craft beer. So if beer and wine are your thing, you're in for a big treat because Oregon excels at both of those things. So those are some quick thoughts on what to do in Oregon when you come out and visit this summer, Robert. So if I don't talk to you before that, safe travels, and I'd love to hear what you did while you were here. So you're going to have to give me an update for sure. Okay, let's see. I've got, let's do one more. I've got one more in here for now. This came in on Facebook Messenger. This is from Dalton. And Dalton says, hey there, I was just interested in finding ways to make my own Italian-style cream sauce. I have a lot of dish ideas with seafood, chicken, and other proteins, but it seems that the only store-bought cream sauces that I can find are all Alfredo. Do you know where I can look to find some ideas? Interesting question, Dalton, and it kind of goes back to that store-bought product idea, so I might have to put store-bought cream sauces on my list of things to try and report back on. But you're right. If you're looking for some sort of an Italian-style cream sauce and you go to the grocery store, 99 out of 100 times, it's just going to be an Alfredo sauce, which is interesting because a traditional original Alfredo sauce doesn't even have cream in it. Many recipes call for it, but the actual original Alfredo sauce was two ingredients. Well, three if you count salt. It was butter and Parmesan Reggiano cheese. And it's so simple to make. You cook your pasta. Maybe you're doing fettuccine Alfredo. You'd cook your fettuccine, and then you would toss it with diced butter, grated Parmesan cheese, and a little bit of the pasta, starchy pasta water to kind of help it emulsify. You toss that together, and that was your Alfredo sauce. There's no cream. It doesn't mean making it with cream is a bad thing, because like I said, lots of recipes call for that. But it's interesting that you can approximate a pretty luscious, rich sauce without even adding any cream. But I digress. Here's two answers to your question, though, really. And the first one doesn't even have anything to do with Italy. And that is I would master a bechamel sauce, right? So that's the French sauce that is essentially a light roux with milk to make a it's not cream per se, but it's a white sauce to which you can add cream. You could add cheese and things like that. I think once you master a bechamel sauce, you can vary it however you like with whatever flavors and add-ins that you like. But once you get that basic bechamel down pat, that's going to open up a pretty big world of experimentation for you. Now, a bechamel sauce starts with a roux, of course. So it's a little bit different than a very simple cream sauce, which would be the other side of that coin. And I would say then, Dalton, is just master a very simple cream sauce and then figure out what kind of add-ins you want. So I just quickly Googled, because they're all relatively similar, right? But I just Googled basic Italian cream sauce, and I found a good one from Rachel Ray. I think I just disparaged Rachel Ray's cookbook a minute ago. But this is a very simple sauce. It requires heavy cream, butter, salt, a little bit of parsley, and some Parmigiano Reggiano cheese. So you essentially heat the cream, butter, some salt, to a simmer until it's thick, you know, 4 or 5 minutes, and then you stir in the parsley, remove it from heat, then stir in the cheese. That's about as simple as it gets for a basic cream sauce. But once you get that, you can add in all sorts of other things that you can really use your imagination with the types of proteins or the vegetables that you're cooking with. For example, one of my favorite add-ins to a sauce like this would be sun-dried tomatoes and a little bit of lemon. So you can make a lemon sun-dried tomato cream sauce, and that's a delightful sauce for chicken and pasta, for example. You can switch out the Parmigiano Reggiano cheese for other types of cheeses. You can add in things, other things besides parsley to give it different flavor profiles. You can go down the path of making a sous vide, which is basically an onion, a pureed onion cream sauce. So there's all sorts of things you can do once you just either master one or the other, or both, preferably the bechamel and the simple cream sauce. You can really start playing with the flavor profiles you want to use. I can't think of a lot of, off the top of my head, I'm actually kind of blanking on actual named Italian cream sauces. I mean, yeah, Alfredo would be one of the common ones that you typically hear. I mean, even like a carbonara sauce isn't even cream, really. It's more like, it more gets the creaminess from the egg that's worked into it. But I know that's probably not exactly the answer you're looking for, and maybe you were looking for specific recipes, but I will definitely link to a good bechamel recipe and this cream sauce recipe that I found, Dalton, that I think that will get you on the right path. And you'll never have to buy another jar of that questionable grocery store Alfredo sauce again. All right, everybody, that's going to do it for the episode today. Like I said at the beginning, I am still working on that pasta and a wine episode. Those will be forthcoming. But in the meantime, I just wanted to get this out for you. Again, show notes for this episode are at kitchencounterpodcast.com/152. And if you'd like to get a hold of me, quickest way to do that is by sending an email to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com or hopping over to the Facebook group at kitchencounterpodcast.com/group. All right, then that's going to do it for today's episode. You know, I really, really appreciate all of you tuning in, listening, sending me your questions, sending me your feedback, joining the Facebook group and interacting with our great community of folks over there. It's really, really great. Please tell your friends and family about the podcast if you think they would enjoy it and get some value out of it. That would mean the world to me. And of course, if you're so inclined, you could head over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast, wherever you listen to this podcast. And if the system allows you, you could leave a rating or review. Okay, everybody, thank you so much one more time for tuning in. I'm Roger with the Kitchen Counter Podcast. And until next time, happy cooking.